get intimate with someone else's cock. But the thing about having one inside you was that it was difficult to really appreciate the, well, the subtleties. The flushes of colour that rushed over the head. The tender stretch of the foreskin with its dark, dancing veins. All the places he was extra sensitive. The puzzle box of touches that made him arch and drip, and turned his breathing ragged. I glanced up, dreamily. Yes?
Talk to me.
For a second or two I was topic bereft. But then I realized he probably didn't want to discuss the political situation in Syria. Keep me with you, he told me once. Slipping a hand under his balls, I treated them to some attention. How's this feel? Good?
That's not talking to me. That's asking me things.
It's engaging you in conversation. It counts. To make my point, I lightly circled the exposed delta of tissue on the underside of his shaft. And he threw an arm across his face and smothered a groan. The lovely, raw sound, too sweet for pain. You're still okay with this, right? I asked.
I am.
His head moved restlessly against the pillow.
Though I am at a loss to understand what you're getting out of it.
Are you kidding me? I get to watch you and touch you and please you. I shifted my grip, giving him long, sensuous strokes. Building pleasure like a fire in winter. I am pleasing you, aren't I?
Yes.
He swallowed a gasp. He was such a tantalizing collection of contrasts just then. The sharp lines of his drawn-tight muscles and his bliss-softened mouth, half-hidden by the shadow of his wrist. I hoped he felt beautiful, because he was. He so was. He made me want to be an octopus. I mean, not actually. Japanese wood carvings aside, he probably wouldn't have been into me anymore. But I could seriously have used some extra arms. He was all ridges and grooves, sweat gleam upon straining skin, and I yearned to stroke him everywhere. Smooth my palms down his trembling stomach, press my fingers into the damp hollows behind his collarbones. Gentle his struggles, as well as inspire them. His fist clenched into the sheets. I'm right here. It's all right. It was an inane thing to say, considering what was happening. But apparently it was what I had. You're doing so well. You're wonderful. Honestly, I didn't know what the fuck I was going on about. Except with the same instinct that had once sent me to my knees on a balcony in Oxford. Some part of me recognized it was what he needed. Look at me, I whispered. A tremor shook his whole body.
I can't.
Please?
Don't.
You need to. You need to see. I worked him steadily, lavishing him with all the care my hands could give. You need to see what I do when I look at you. He was right on the edge of orgasm. I could feel him there. A dancer not yet dancing, though I wasn't the one holding him back. He stirred agitatedly, his spine bowing, hips buckling, one foot braced against the bed, until at last he pulled his arm away. His face was flushed with hectic pleasure and damp with desperation, moisture matted into the hair at his brow and glittering on his lashes. Even wrecked, he was lovely. One of those naughty 17th-century poems I hadn't revised properly. Delight in disorder and all that. His eyes found mine. Wary enough to break my heart. But it was okay. I gazed at him full of submission and hope and love and certainty.
because I knew that even if he caught only the reflected shadow of everything inside me, it would still be enough. And he'd understand that I was his and he was mine and could be everything that mattered. "You're perfect," I told him. "I wish you knew how beautiful you are, and how strong and kind, how good." He made a broken sound and came, trembling frantically, covering my fingers in his own stomach. And for the briefest of moments, he let me see his pleasure in all its nakedness before he retreated behind his arm. Grabbing my t-shirt from the floor, I cleaned us up and then went to retrieve the duvet. My preference would have been insta-snuggling, but I thought he might appreciate a minute or two to himself. And sure enough, when I came back, he seemed a lot more put together, which was a shame because I liked him sex-rumpled and a little bit unraveled. I cast the duvet over the bed and bounced up beside him, hoping everything was still okay. The seesaw of equanimity had clearly decided it was my turn to get anxious because suddenly I was convinced he was going to resent what had just happened or have some terrible reaction to it he hadn't seen fit to tell me about. Instead, he turned my face to his and kissed me. It wasn't rough, but it was bone-meltingly deep, and I surrendered to it gratefully, to the gentle dominion of lips and teeth and tongue. When he finally let me go, I realized I was oddly wobbly, happy wobbly, like after he'd spanked me that time. The same sense of being stripped down somehow, as if he'd taken a pumice stone to my soul and left me fresh and shiny and vulnerable. It made no sense because what we'd done had been so different. Or actually, maybe it hadn't. "Thank you," I mumbled. "That was amazing. The best."
"But what about you?"
"What about me? Oh, you mean..." It seemed a bit weird to be turning down sexual attention, but I kind of felt like I'd had sexual attention. "I'm okay."
"That doesn't seem fair."
"You gave me what I needed, just like always. How isn't that fair?" He made an unconvinced noise. "I'd rather cuddle and share your afterglow. You do have an afterglow, right? I gave you an afterglow."
"Yes, I'm..."
He blushed.
"Glowy."
My eyes got big and hopeful. "Is cuddling an option?" He answered by pulling me into his arms. I tucked in as close as I dared, sinking into his warmth, and letting the scent of his skin, sweat, sex, the fading notes of his cologne, and something I recognized as purely him, wash over me.
"Though I think I might want a cigarette,"
he murmured, after a minute or two. I partially denestled. "I'll go."
"I'm perfectly capable of getting them myself."
"Well, I know that. But I want to. Where are they?"
"Jacket pocket."
I kissed the corner of his mouth, scrambled out of bed and went looking. As love quests went, it was minor. I didn't meet any fantastical beasts or get my head chopped off. But I liked being able to do something for him. It seemed domestic. The sort of small task a partner might do. I even remembered to grab a saucer for the ash. Wow, I was the best. "Can I light it for you?" I asked on my triumphant return. One of his eyebrows twitched upward.
"I think you might be overestimating the power of your handjob. It was very nice, but I'm still functional."
"I just thought it would be romantic," I grinned at him, in what I hoped was an appealing fashion. You know, like Bogart and Bacall, Davis and Heinried, Grant and Scott. I mean, unless you think I'll set your face on fire or something.
I don't think you'll set my face on fire.
He took the packet of cigarettes I brought him, drew one out of the foil and put it to his lips. And, obviously, smoking was bad, and everyone knew it was bad, but he looked so sexy. Half-naked, stretched out in bed, still languid with post-orgasmic sensuality. This perfect embodiment of old Hollywood glamour. Except nobody had to pretend they were straight. I fumbled a match out of the box. I should light one for me too, and then we could put the tips together and do it that way.
I'm not letting you smoke.
Is it up to you?
Since they're my cigarettes, yes.
But then he smiled unexpectedly.
Besides, you're terrible at it, Arden. And I'd rather you didn't take up an unhealthy habit.
It's your unhealthy habit.
Indeed. And there are many other aspects of my life I would prefer you didn't repeat.
I blinked at him. Really? You don't think I should aspire to be rich, successful, brilliant, and gorgeous?
I think you should be exactly who you are. Including all the ways you are not like me.
I couldn't quite untangle what was a compliment and what wasn't. But I was getting distracted anyway. I didn't actually want to smoke. I was just getting bratty because I'd been told I couldn't. And it was extra nonsensical because Caspian not wanting me to get cancer and die was hardly the height of oppression. So I stopped arguing and lit his cigarette for him. And I didn't make a total hash of it. Yay! Caspian was pretty casual about the whole thing, but I was strangely touched. Maybe because I was thinking of Oxford again. His smoking had been this private ritual then, and he'd seemed like an impossible fantasy of a man, as beyond me as the stars and the golden towers. Except the truth of him was so much more. Making sure the match was out, I dropped the box on the bedside cabinet and snuggled up to Caspian. Watched the curls of smoke drifting from between his lips. Was it wrong that I found it hot? Of course, I would have preferred him to have a non-harmful hobby. But I don't think he did it enough for it to be very damaging. Are you going to stay? I said instead.
If you'd like me to.
Let me think about it, yes. He laughed, but quickly turned serious again.
I can't promise to be the best sleeping companion.
I'll try not to flip out this time.
Thank you.
I'm incredibly jet-lagged anyway. I probably won't notice if you slip out to join a mariachi band. He stubbed out his cigarette, put the saucer to one side, and drew me fully into his arms.
Then you should sleep, my Arden.
Will you? I brushed a finger against the corner of his eye. You look tired, too.
I missed you.
I was going to say something about my absence being no excuse for Caspian not taking proper care of himself. But I was too cozy. Too cozy for anything except snuggling. And a bit of happy mumble purring. At some point I did become vaguely aware of being disentangled. Nudged gently across the bed and tucked up. But it was okay. I could still feel the shape of Caspian behind me. And the pattern of his breath was as comforting as the fall of raindrops against my window back in Kinloch Bearvie. Chapter 22. Of course, I woke up alone. And, thanks to jet lag, it was still the middle of the night. I rolled about trying to re-snuggle, but it wasn't happening. The empty space beside me just made me sad. Even though I knew Caspian wasn't trying to hurt me, any more than I was doing something to drive him away. The last time I'd gone looking for him hadn't exactly been a rousing success. But we'd both been independently messed up, and, presumably, if I didn't descend on him wailing about Nathaniel like I'd been possessed by the spirit of lovers past, it would go better. And anyway, if I could spontaneously ask Poppy Carrie for an interview, I could go and find Caspian. Hell, yes, I could. Throwing off the covers, I scrabbled about on the floor for my pajama bottoms and padded out into the hall. I expected he'd be in the living area, but he wasn't. It was empty, caught in the eerie half-light of the city's ceaseless glow. Maybe he was sleeping somewhere else. Except no sign of him in any of the bedrooms. Shit. Maybe he'd left. Fuck me sideways, he'd better not have. If he'd fucked off on me after last night, Well, I had no idea what I'd do. But I knew this wasn't the sort of thing I'd get over. My stomach knotted with a strange mixture of preemptive anger and fear, while my heart was already begging, "Please don't do this to me, Caspian." Then I heard it. A gasping sound, almost like a sob. I turned, followed it like a ninja. And for the record, I wouldn't normally have burst in on someone in the bathroom, especially if weird noises were involved, but the door was half open and I could see Caspian inside. He was braced against the marble counter, head down. What I could see of his face in the mirror was pale, sweat damp like his tangled hair, and he was trembling violently. "Don't tell me I'd done this to him again." "Caspian?" He glanced up, his reflected eyes red-rimmed, damp and desolate, meeting mine only briefly. "What's wrong? Are you..." I remembered just in time how he'd reacted to the word triggered. "Is it like before?"
"No, no, nothing like that. I'm..." "Oh, God, don't laugh."
"Of course I..." My assurance was lost as he rushed on.
"I had a dream."
I guess maybe some people might have found it funny. He was, after all, a grown man, and a powerful one, and only children were supposed to be scared of dreams. But I'd heard my mum begging and screaming in hers way too often to take them lightly.
"You mean a nightmare?"
After a moment, he nodded. "Do you want to talk about it? It's okay if you don't, but sometimes it helps. Was someone hurting you?"
"No, I...
Suddenly he spun away from the counter and pulled me into his arms so fiercely it almost knocked the wind out of me. I hugged him back, and for once, he didn't protest or pull away. His body this tangle of physical anguish against mine. All hot, rough breath and the panicked heartbeat of a wounded beast. And then before I quite knew what was happening, he was on his knees, clinging to me.
"I was hurting you," he whispered.
It felt about 87 types of weird to be standing when Caspian wasn't. On any other occasion, I would probably have hit the floor too in order to balance things out. But I knew that wasn't what he needed from me tonight. So I stopped worrying. Curled my fingers very lightly into his hair, trying to soothe him. "It was only a dream."
"You were crying, Arden. And screaming. And there was blood on your back and you were begging me to stop. And I didn't."
"It was a dream," I said again. "Only a dream." His fingers tightened. Digging hard enough into the backs of my thighs, I was sure he was leaving bruises.
"It felt so good."
"Yes, but that doesn't mean anything." He didn't answer, just stifled another miserable sound. I'm serious. You'd never do something like that in real life.
Arden.
He looked up at me with his restless ocean eyes, so full of unfathomed pain.
You have no idea what I'm capable of.
It was the easiest thing in the world, right then, to hold his gaze. I know you'd never hurt me in ways I didn't want to be hurt. I know you'd never break my trust, and I know that whatever you've done or whatever's been done to you, you're a good person. I could sense the protests gathering inside him. Any second now he was going to say something devastatingly rational about how I couldn't be sure, and then we were going to have a big argument because on this particular subject I wasn't yielding. Not for him, not for anyone. But I guess he was still too raw, because he let me hold him instead. And we stayed there like that for long enough. I started to worry about his knees on the marble floor. When my mum had nightmares, we turned on every light in the house and checked every room. That wouldn't work for Caspian, though. He had different demons, which wasn't to say they couldn't be conquered. I touched his shoulder gently. Come back to bed.
You still want?
I knew it was rude to interrupt, but sometimes you had to. More than anything in the world. My body had apparently given up on time zones, because when I next woke up it was still far too early, especially for a Saturday. To my slight surprise, Caspian was beside me, as close as he could get without us actually touching. God, he must have been exhausted, because he was out. And whereas when I was asleep I looked like a concussed bunny drooling and twitching and snuffling my nose, I knew because Nick had been kind enough to record me, even after last night, Caspian looked beautiful, like he belonged in an arty black-and-white photo series. He was lying on his stomach, head turned to the side, one arm flung across the pillow, the other curled neatly beside him. The covers had slipped down, exposing his shoulders and the long sweep of his spine, and the teeniest hint of buttock curve. His hair was an adorable ruffle across his brow, and his eyelashes were infuriating. I mean, did he need them that thick and dark and soft? Really? Did he? When the rest of him was so ridiculously exquisite, he could have afforded one less than perfect feature. Except I loved his contrasts, his strengths and his secrets, like his lavish eyelashes, his delicate collarbones, and the enticingly tender skin of his flanks. I stared at him, creepily, for a while, partially because I could and Caspian would never know, but also because my phone was flashing super insistently and I wasn't ready to face whatever I was being messaged about. Not when I could live in the shadows of Caspian's far too lovely eyelashes. Finally, though, I forced myself to get out of bed, creeping into the living area so I wouldn't disturb Caspian. Strips of pale yellow-grey sunlight fell across my feet, making them look jaundiced. Oh, England, with your half-assed summers. I was so happy to be home. I glanced down at my phone. Holy shit, that was a lot of notifications. Which, once again, I wasn't conscious of having done anything to inspire. Sighing, I googled Ellery. Nothing new. Myself. Nothing new. And finally, yesterday's event. I was fairly reassured that I had to hunt to find it. But there it was in a particular scurrilous gossip rag. Keeping it in the family. Aloof billionaire Caspian Hart steals sister's squeeze. And a fuzzy side-by-side of two me's. one eating strawberries with Ellery, and one holding Caspian's hand outside the gallery. So, yeah. That was pretty icky. And typical, honestly, that the public record of Nathaniel's relationship with Caspian was all glossy couples pics from charity events, whereas I was turning into a tabloid headline-generating floozy. But whatever. Being with Caspian probably meant some of this stuff was inevitable. I forwarded the article to Belrose, just in case, and turned to my emails. A few were related to my own writing. One was from Milieu. Ooh. The rest were Nick, Sophie, Weird Owen, Professor Standish, Oxford University notifications. Oh, fuck. Fuck, 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 fuck. This could only mean one thing. My results were out. I could have put it off. Once upon a time I would have. But not anymore. I had an article coming out in Milieu, a respectable army of Instagram followers, a billionaire lover who fucked me and cherished me and let me comfort him when he needed it. I'd danced all night in a secret rave in an abandoned building, flown to Boston to be with a friend, interviewed Poppy Carey in a hospital caff. Frankly, Oxford could suck my balls. I dug my password out of the sludge in the bottom of my brain and logged into the student self-service. And there it was. Arden St. Ives. 2.2. The rest of the non-work emails were mostly congratulations. Polite congratulations. Professor Standish said she hoped this wouldn't hold me back because she knew I was very capable when I put my mind to it. Weird Owen had helpfully gone to exam schools and taken a photo of the public list for me. I was right at the bottom. Worst mark in college. Even druggy Matt, who'd been off his face in every tutorial, had managed a 2-1. So, yeah. 2-2. The result you got when you weren't competent enough for a 2-1 or incompetent enough for a third. A 2-1 said, I did what I was supposed to do. A third said, I gave no fucks about doing what I was supposed to do. And a 2-2 said, nothing at all. I was a squeak of inglorious inadequacy. I waited for the sky to fall. I waited to burst into tears. But the world stayed right way up. And I was totally and completely fine. Huh. Well, time to see what Milieu had to say. Which was, if anything, even more nerve-wracking. They'd got back to me much quicker than last time, which made me suspect I was either moving up in the world or about to suffer a devastating Insta rejection. But it was good-ish news. I think. They liked the interview, though it would need a lot of work, and to run it at the length they felt it deserved, it would have to be a main feature. Meaning they wanted Poppy for the cover. And so, since she was essentially my contact, I had to email her. And what with it being still the middle of the night in Boston, and the weekend, it would probably sit in her inbox 4 hours. If not days. Holy tenterhooks, Batman!
Arden?
Caspian's voice startled me away from my phone. Sorry, I'm here! I ran back into the bedroom, found Caspian sitting up and bleary-eyed, pushing the hair out of his face.
I'm starting to see, he said, why you object so much to waking up alone.
Did you miss me? I jumped back into bed.
I wouldn't say I missed you exactly.
Wow, thanks. He gave me a look.
Well, I knew you were unlikely to have gone far.
You could still miss me, though.
I certainly awoke and was aware of your absence.
If you ever get sick of being a billionaire, you could work for Hallmark. I mimed titles flying through the air. I am aware of your absence. I may have mildly inconvenienced you. My concern on this non-ideal occasion.
Oh, shush.
I'd never seen someone try to laugh while they were scowling, or scowl while they were laughing. Anyway, it was pretty special. Then he twisted a hand in my hair and pulled me in for a kiss that felt like reward and punishment all at once. "Caspian," I mumbled against his mouth.
"Yes, my Arden."
"I failed Oxford." He drew back a little. Not in a recoiling from my ignorance way. More just giving me space.
"You failed? Nobody fails Oxford. You mean you got a third?"
2-2. That's worse than a third."
"It demonstrably is not."
"You and your damned logic," I sighed. "Sorry. I guess. I don't know. I can't figure out how I feel. I'm supposed to be wrecked. Why aren't I wrecked?"
"Perhaps," he said with gentle mischief, "you've developed a sense of proportion."
Have you met me?" He leaned in and kissed my nose.
"When you're there, Oxford seems like the whole world. And its values the only values that matter. But you've been flourishing elsewhere, and in your own way for months now. At this point, your degree classification is largely irrelevant."
"I do," I squirmed with an almost uncontainable sense of liberation, "feel maybe that I'm flourishing. Milieu might want my interview as well."
"I'm so proud of you, both for what you've achieved at Oxford and beyond."
"Ah, too much, too much." I flumped over and pulled a pillow over my face. "Oh, God, what are you doing to me?"
"What on earth's the matter now?"
"I can't cope when you're this lovely. I don't deserve it."
"Is that so?"
He wrestled the pillow away and rolled on top of me, sliding his knee between my legs. Last night's nightmare seemed very distant indeed as he gazed down at me like a wolf with an exceptionally delicious rabbit between its paws.
"Because I can also be terribly cruel."
My cock got so hard so quickly it practically sproinged. "Fuck yes! Please be cruel to me!" He caught my lower lip between his teeth and tugged until I whimpered. It was such a sweet, sharp pain.
"But first," he murmured, "let me make something very clear.
Some boys liked diamonds. I liked being sexually threatened." I nodded eagerly. "Okay."
"When it comes to me, I decide what you deserve. And I will feel proud of you when I damn well please."
He nipped at my chin, then moved down my neck, making the skin dance under the scrape of his teeth.
"Understood."
I tipped my head, already breathless. "Yes."
"Good. Now then, shall we see what you deserve today?"
Apparently what I deserved was to beg and moan. A lot. To get covered in bites and bruises. To be sweaty and mindless and helpless. And finally, when I was literally crying, to come like the end of the fucking universe. Leaving me used and abused. And sated and happy. Caspian had to fly to New York on Sunday. But apart from the time I spent on the phone, first to my folks, who were thrilled for me, and then to Nick, who'd got a first, of course, he was all mine for Saturday. Remembering how much he'd enjoyed our family game night, and facing up to the fact that I was never, ever, ever going to be remotely interested in learning how not to suck at chess, even from Caspian. I took him down to a board game shop in Seven Dials. He wanted to call a car, but I insisted we walk, since it was only half an hour through Hyde Park and Mayfair. And that turned out to be exactly the right call, because the day was shiny with sunlight and Caspian let me hold his hand, and for a little while we were lost together in the London crowds. Just another couple. I thought I was never getting Caspian out of the shop, but we finally settled on a few two-player games. Caspian chose Hive, because the assistant described it as like chess with insects, and I went for Fungi, because it was about mushrooms. We headed home via our local Waitrose so I could buy lunch, picnic food mainly, of the sort best nibbled between committed bouts of sex and board games. And I wasn't sure Caspian had ever been in a supermarket, or at least had forgotten how they worked, because he looked distinctly bewildered the whole time we were there. I spent the afternoon having my arse handed to me, in a non-sexual way, by an increasingly apologetic Caspian. But it worked out okay, since I was far more attracted to his ruthlessness than I was embarrassed by my own abundance of ruth. And I got to tease him about it and make him blush, which was far more satisfying than winning anyway. Then we watched The Force Awakens again. I tried to tell Caspian other movies existed, that even other Star Wars movies existed. But he said he felt he might have missed things the first time round and wanted to study the film further. Because he was a ginormous dork. It was more Star Wars than I would normally have been up for. But I liked. No, I loved being able to indulge Caspian. Draw out his tentative pleasures. Catch the gleam of happiness as it crept shyly into his eyes. Also, real talk, my toenails were a complete state, and this gave me an opportunity to sort them out. Even if it meant subjecting the man I desired most in the universe to the sight of me hunched over on the sofa like an elderly baboon. Or, you know, Yoda before he got all CGI. I went for blue-black glitter and teeny-tiny silver stars, because I thought Caspian would like it. And I guess he did, because he threw my freshly beautified feet over his shoulders and fucked me into a puddle of happy goo as the credits rolled. Probably ruining the Star Wars theme for me forever. Or improving it immeasurably. I couldn't quite decide. After that, I was pretty much done for. But it turned out Caspian wanted to take me out for dinner. As in, put on clothes, call a car, spend more money than I was comfortable with, maybe we could just stay home and I could make pasta instead. Dinner. Apparently he wanted to celebrate my accomplishments, and he wouldn't take no for an answer. Not that I tried to say no very hard. And it was quite a complicated no anyway. Because the no-ness was largely about the fact I would never be able to do anything like this for him. But what I really wanted to say was yes. Because while it involved far more chauffeuring and Michelin stars than I was used to, it was a date. A date with Caspian Hart. He wore charcoal grey with a slate grey shirt, a maroon tie and a dark gold pocket square, and looked, as ever, ridiculously gorgeous and well put together. So I nobly pulled on my one suit, my crappy exam-doing suit, only for Caspian to send me back into the bedroom to change. It wasn't until I re-emerged, this time in rainbow tie-dye skinny jeans, a T-shirt and my plum velvet jacket, that I realized he'd dressed for me. Not in the sense that we looked remotely similar, but he'd clearly chosen his tie to complement my jacket. The boldest splash in his otherwise subdued palette, like a private tribute to my very favourite colour. In the car, he passed me a neat little parcel and explained,
We were instructed to bring a book.
To dinner? He nodded.
I hope you don't mind that I had Belrose provide one.
Did he also pick the restaurant?
He...
Caspian got all pinkish at the top of his cheekbones.
Helped me come up with something you would like.
Maybe I should go out with him.
I would strenuously object.
I unwrapped the book and burst out laughing. It was a Folio Society edition of Rebecca. The restaurant turned out to be this wood cabin built on a traffic island near London Bridge. Inside it was clean and unfussy, all grown-up shades of brown, and books everywhere. There was even one on our table, a copy of Eros the Bittersweet. And it turned out the whole deal was about telling stories through food. Which I... Yeah. Cheesy or not, I loved it. And best of all, they had a tasting menu, so I was saved from having to order. Something I always hated. I mean, not what beans I wanted in my burrito, but there was way too much pressure in fancy places. You had to worry about the price of things, whether you were paying or not, and also what your choices might be saying about you. Like, if you had the beef after the crab, did that mean you were a yahoo, and everyone was secretly laughing? And, on top of all that, was the major commitment you were making to a large, expensive plate of food that you might not even like. But this way I got to sit there and enjoy a candlelit Caspian, and the food took care of itself, arriving as part of what seemed to be an endless parade of exciting nibbles, some of which, I'll admit, were slightly challenging for a middle-class boy who grew up in the middle of nowhere. But I quickly got swept up in the drama of never quite knowing what was going to turn up next. We had savoury Oreos, called Storios, made with squid ink and eel mousse, and crispy cod skin with cod roe emulsion and black pudding topped with pineapple. And that was before the meal had even properly started. I didn't think my bouche had ever been so comprehensively amused. They brought us pouches of sourdough next, served with condiments. And I literally squealed when it turned out the candle was made of beef fat and had been quietly forming a pool of warm, meaty deliciousness for us to dip the bread into. I did quite a lot of squealing, actually, as the various dishes appeared. Squealing, squeaking, gasping, occasionally even waving my hands in the air. Everything was just so pretty and playful and weird, like the teeny tiny mashed potato served with coal oil, or the snow-white apple that was presented to us in a bowl of billowing dry ice and opened up to reveal beef tartare and truffle, or the tiny little milk bottles that were full of rhubarb and custard soda. And Caspian. God, I don't quite know. He was looking at me the way he looked at Star Wars. Which made me so happy I got scared. Because it made me realize that I'd been with Caspian longer than I'd ever been with anyone, and I had no idea what it meant. Our relationship had started with a blowjob on a balcony, progressed to a pre-negotiated short-term sexual arrangement, and then exploded. And now it was nothing and everything, and we were in a restaurant together, and was he my... boyfriend? Was Caspian Hart my boyfriend? And did I even want him to be, since it generally resulted in me going off someone pretty quickly? Was it really worth worrying about? It was obvious Caspian liked me, and liked me far more than I was used to being liked. More than any reasonable person ought to like me, in all honesty. But I couldn't help wondering. Did it feel for him the way it felt for me? These Icarus wings, heavy on your back and full of the promise of power, drawing you higher and higher and faster, until you couldn't tell any more whether you were flying or falling or soaring or drowning. Chapter 23. I'd meant to be delightful when Caspian left, sending him across the ocean with the sweetness of my kisses lingering on his lips. But unfortunately our parting took place at 4 a.m., and so I was mainly half asleep, mumbly and pathetic. I think I got my message across, though, especially when I wrapped my arms around his leg and wouldn't let go.
"I'll be back next Saturday,"
he said, trying to sound exasperated and actually just laughing.
"Please let go. I don't want to be late."
"No! I'm keeping you!"
"Arden,"
I whimpered, tragically. "Promise you'll come and see me straight away, as soon as you land."
"It's Eleanor's birthday. Have you forgotten?"
Oh, shit. Where had August gone? Only technically.
"How about..."
He peeled my hand gently off his knee and gave it a squeeze.
"I pick you up and we go together."
That startled me almost awake. "You want to take me to, a family thing?"
"Why not? You were invited."
"I know, but it seems serious, doesn't it?"
"If you're uncomfortable, I can meet you there."
"No! Oops, caps lock, Ardy strikes back. It was too late to sound nonchalant now, but I tried. "It's cool." He smiled and bent down to kiss my nose.
"Then it's a date."
The sheer sweetness of those words left me floating through Sunday in a happy haze. On Monday, though, work happened to me. I honestly hadn't expected Poppy to say yes, since all we'd discussed was the interview. But she did, as long as I was still involved. And from then on, everything became a flurry of agents and publicists and contracts and... ah! It took most of the week, untold emails and even a couple of conference calls, all of which felt way above my pay grade. Especially because I didn't have a pay grade. But somehow, by Thursday, it had all come together. And with the end in sight, an email plinked into my inbox that was only to me. It was from Mara Fairfax, the editor of Milieu, and it said, "Do come along to the office this afternoon. 2. 9 words and the world's most unconvincing question mark. As impenetrable as a text from someone you fancied when you weren't quite sure if they fancied you back. Was this a casual visit? A job interview? Did they want to just look at me like I was a monkey at the zoo? Still, at least I didn't have long to fret about it. A little before 2, I'd navigated a receptionist and was ascending to the appropriate floor of a moderately ugly portico-fronted office block off Hanover Square. A woman, a leggy brunette in pearls and ballet flats, was waiting for me at the far end of a long white corridor, where the words Milieu, established 1702, was picked out in gigantic shiny letters on the wall.
"You're Arden, aren't you?"
she said, stepping forward.
"I'm Tabitha. Tabitha England Plume, and yes, I'm a real person, and that's my real name. You can look me up if you like. I'm in the Bible."
I shook her hand dazedly. "Were you Begat?"
"The other Bible. Debrett's."
"Oh. The thing is, I haven't actually..."
"Don't worry. Mara'll give you a copy. It's all terribly silly, really."
She led me under the Milieu sign and into the office itself. I was braced for the full Devil Wears Prada, but actually it was kind of banal. Plainly decorated with computers tucked into cubicles, it could have been the admin block for almost anything. The Wernham Hog Paper Company. Maybe half of the workstations were occupied, all of them frighteningly tidy.
"Mara's nuts about clutter-free working," said Tabitha. "This way."
I hurried after her down another corridor, this one lined by framed Milieu covers. Things gradually got shinier, Through their glass walls I caught glimpses of fancy meeting spaces and rooms so full of clothing racks you could barely have wriggled it inside. Mara's own office, when we finally got there, was large, but not swaggeringly so. It was clean and bright, austerely decorated with a few black and white prints, and what I took to be a personal photograph of a laughing girl and a horse. There was room for a sofa and glass-topped desk and a large table, currently strewn with photographs, which was where the action seemed to be happening. A woman, who I thought was Mara Fairfax, was leaning over the images, studying them with a focus bordered on ferocity. Her colleague, probably the photographer, had her hips braced against the edge of the table, one foot in a perfectly polished Oxford, swinging idly. She was pretty much the picture of glamorous nonchalance, in high-waisted pinstripe trousers held up by braces over a low-cut white shirt. But then she reached out to Mara and tucked a strand of her honey-brown hair gently behind her ear, which Mara herself hardly seemed to notice.
"Well," she said, "I think any of these three could be a cover. Or maybe just these two. I like her face in this one. There's a softness there, almost a whimsy, which isn't a side of her we usually see. But this one, the shape of her body." Her hand traced a curve. "It's pure Kate."
The photographer tapped the second.
"This is it, I think. Let's try it."
Mara straightened up, and then with a wave of her hand,
"Come in, you two. Have a seat."
Hello. I perched on the edge of one of the chairs in front of Mara's desk.
"I'm Mara Fairfax, and I'm sure you've heard of George here."
Was this a test? There was really only one notable George in the British magazine photography industry. I'd seen what I assumed to be his name, credited on so many fashion and editorial shoots. Time Out, Skin 2, Vogue, Milieu. George Chase. "You're George Chase."
"It's so convenient when one's reputation precedes one."
She reached into the pocket of her trousers and pulled out her card case. Flicking it open, she extricated a business card and held it out to me between two agile, knotty, knuckled fingers. It was matte black, faintly textured under my thumb, a barely visible circular pattern that suggested the shape of a lens. All it said was, "Georgia Chase, Libertine Rouet, photographer," and then a website.
"Anyway," said Mara, effortlessly reclaiming my attention, "thank you for coming in, Arden. You've sent us quite some interesting pieces."
"I have. Gosh, thank you." Mara Fairfax wasn't what I'd expected. But then my expectation had probably been thrown off by too much Meryl Streep. She was about 5 years older than George. Maybe more. Not exactly beautiful, but classically English. All strong bones and clear skin. And the sturdy athleticism of having spent most of your life on horseback.
"Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?"
I glanced from Mara to George and back again. Still not entirely sure what was happening. After a dithery couple of moments, I decided to risk a direct approach. I mean, what was the worst that could happen? Apart from excruciating personal embarrassment, that is. "I hope you don't mind me asking, but why am I here?"
"I'm deciding whether I like you."
"And what happens if you do?"
"Then I offer you a job."
I successfully managed to not fall off my chair. Go me. "At Milieu. OMG. I mean, holy shit, that would be a dream come true. But I should tell you, I just got my degree results, and I sort of, I got a 2-2. There was a silence. I waited to be escorted from the building. Tabitha laughed.
I got a third.
And Mara here, said George, grinning, was sent down.
She shrugged. If I hadn't been, I would never have met you. Oh, please, God, no.
That was Tabitha.
No more stories about New York in the 80s. It was a golden age you once threw up on Andy Warhol, we get it.
Alas, poor Tabs. The most exciting thing you've ever vomited over are your Jimmy Choos. George climbed lazily to her feet. But in any case, I should leave you all to your chat. She began gathering up her photographs, pausing only to glance my way. I do hope we meet again, Poppet. And with that, she sauntered out, leaving me genuinely unable to figure out whether I was relieved or not. She seemed kind of into me, which probably meant she was my ally in whatever was happening here. But at the same time, she had legs for miles and a fantastic rack, and she kept smirking at me distractedly. So I guess I was overall grateful for her absence. Especially because, so help me God, I was not fucking this up. It was the opportunity of a lifetime, and I wanted it so badly it was making my throat tight and my mouth dry. My brain, of course, was a flurry of uncertainties. It wanted to tell me I wasn't good enough, that I didn't deserve this, that I'd only end up disappointing everyone. But I wasn't listening. I wasn't. I'd earned this chance, worked for it. Milieu and me were made for each other. And I was going to land this job. Because, let's face it, I was likable as fuck. 50 minutes later, I emerged flayed, dazed, giddy, and job-having. Junior assistant editor. I was a junior assistant editor. Truthfully, I was still a bit shaky on what that actually involved. But whatever it was a real thing, and I was going to be paid for it. Not, you know, much. But I'd never been paid for anything before. Unless you counted that time Caspian had established a scholarship in my name after I'd given him a blowjob. I lurched past one of the pits and into Hanover Square, slumped onto a bench amid the swirling green, and messaged everyone I knew with shaking fingers. Caspian first, of course, and he was the first to get back to me, signing his congratulations off with an X, which was incredibly effusive for him. Squeaking in before my family, who sang to me as follows. We knew you could do it, just call it a hunch. All these delicious and nutritious for dinner, breakfast and lunch. Rabbi and Hazel wrote music for adverts and pined after the days of the unironic jingle. So most of my accomplishments were celebrated via cheesy earworm. Tucking my feet onto the edge of the bench, I hugged my knees and watched the shadows of the trees dancing over the grass. I was half expecting to jolt awake and find myself back at Oxford, in my single bed under my crappy duvet, on the morning of my first exam, having desperation dreamed this whole absurd fable, being with Caspian, meeting Ellery, not completely fucking up my finals, landing a job at Milieu. Except no. This was my life. This was really my life. I bounced up, flung wide my arms, and wheeled in circles, accompanied by a few startled pigeons. Well, I figured I deserved my very own Disney princess moment, even if I did look slightly bonkers. From there, I headed home, where I found Ellery and a bottle of scary expensive congratulatory champagne Caspian had contrived to send me that she'd mostly drunk. Her pink tulle skirt and leather jacket combination made her look like Tinkerbell gone bad. Came to be all yay and shit, she explained. I twitched the champagne from her hand and took a swig. The bubbles rushed up my nose and down my chin and left me sneezing.
Gosh, I was just the coolest.